Hello friends, I'm your host, Chris Thrall. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando. I've adventured, for better and sometimes worse, across 80 countries on all 7 continents. Welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast.
Boom, you're live for the second time on this this New Year's Eve. We just got taken off air, folks. I will explain why. But first, have a look at one of my guests this evening.
If it riles anybody else's opinions or their narrative, we're going to see what's going on and we're going to report on it.
We are off Arno. You can see the White Cliffs quite well. Dover Port is off to the right. I think we're heading towards Folkestone.
Four tours of Iraq and Afghanistan with a special forces unit.
It's probably why people were telling us we're mental and we're going to die and not to do it.
Boom, it's my great pleasure to welcome Lee West, Royal Marines, who crossed the English Channel in a dinghy just to check out if we have any kind of border force, and my good friend, channel co-host, Kenny Williams. Let's get into it. Boom, gentlemen, what a massive Merry New Year. our video extravaganza, it didn't turn
Happy
out to
days.
Plan, did it?
AI
doesn't like us.
Yes, so friends, if you're joining us for a second time this evening, apparently when I played the introduction to Kenny's podcast that he did with me, in which we revisited our time in the Northern Ireland conflict, there's one photo for literally a split second of, let's just say, a very young person holding a wooden bang-bang. Let's just put it like that. It's just a fleeting thing, and we got taken off the air for it. So I'm always telling you, it's a tightrope that we walk here. But yes, we're back, and it seems a shame to go over everything that we said. But friends, just to reiterate, Lee West... Lee, you're a colour sergeant in the Royal Marines, were you not?
Yeah, colour sergeant.
Yes, Lee is now a best-selling author, an entrepreneur, an adventurer, you can say. And while serving in the forces, like I said, he decided to check out the border control, take a dinghy over to France, and hop in it with his mate, literally... motor back to Blighty with a rubber doll on board, just as their asylum seeker passenger.
Did you get your duty free?
Yeah, I was going to say probably you want to avoid the duty free shop for that one. Did you get in trouble? For that, Lee?
For the crossing, we did and we didn't.
The only reason that the police caught up with you is, unlike, you know, illegal immigrants and asylum seekers, you had to stop to pack up all your gear because obviously you'd invested in it, whereas they just get to the shores of it and just run like hell. Is that right?
Or actually hand themselves in, would depend what their preference is. Sometimes they just hand themselves in because they've made it. Yeah, but that's right. So we made it across the channel undetected, hit a shingle beach near Folkestone Harbour, which is unplanned, the exact spot where we're going to land. It was quite unfortunate because it was a shingle beach, so we had to drag all our kit up this beach. It was like a travelator to get it to a promenade, which was a pedestrian promenade as well. So our pickup driver couldn't drive the van down the hill. So by the time we dragged the stuff up the shingle beach, mustered it on the promenade, got comms with him to come and meet, he parked at the top of the hill, where he borrowed a wheelbarrow off a council landscaper to do shuttle runs up and down the hill with our kit. So, of course, this was taking time. It was about an hour we were there. The spot where we landed, the sun had come up by this point while we were packing stuff away, had houses facing it. So, of course, being a resident of that area where boats are turning up all the time, you see two guys rock up at dawn in a dinghy. Of course, your first port of call is going to be the local police. Might want to come and have a look at this, which did happen then. So after about an hour, local police turned up, started questioning us. They weren't getting the answers that they wanted because at this point, me and my friend were just taking the piss out of them. We were having a laugh because we haven't done anything wrong legally by law. We'd broken a few rules, technicalities, but as we weren't actually smuggling people ourselves or people across, apart from the dog. They weren't getting the answers they wanted, so then Border Force turned up, Customs turned up, and eventually the National Crime Agency turned up. And after about another hour of being questioned on the beach, the cuffs came out and we got hauled back to Folkestone Police Station.
Oh, lovely. Isn't it mental how that all can happen to you but on a daily basis? It's madness. We just stood there going, hang on a minute, mate. What the hell are you doing? Have you looked down the coast a little bit, mate? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that is the problem, is 5 minutes prior to us landing, and we only found this out when we got back to the police station because the arresting officer had to justify to the custody sergeant why they were detaining us.
Yeah.
And what came out in that was, which we didn't know until this point, was 5 minutes before we landed, two actual boats, and this is on Sky News about this other boat landing as well, because it was on Sky News that we'd been arrested, and it mentioned this other boat. Two actual boats of actual migrants had landed just down the coast from us 5 minutes before. And unfortunately for us, the two drivers of those boats were ex-military. So, of course, during the questioning, it's, what do you do for a living, Mr. West? Well, I'm a colour sergeant in the Royal Marines, still serving at the time. Paul, with me, used to be in the Royal Engineers, and that's how we met in the forces. So, of course, two and two together, they must be in cahoots with these other two boats who've landed. And
they started quizzing you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and start assisting it. But the questions were coming in, and it was laughable. We had our passports on us. We even showed them social media, which we didn't say before we went that we were doing it on social media. We alluded to it. We're in France. We're going to see if we can do something crazy. So it was a page set up for it because we didn't want to put the exact details because we didn't want to be rumbled, of course, and it get foiled before we even set off. So we told them all this. We were completely honest with them, apart from having a laugh and messing around. And we honestly thought they were just going to go, okay, you're a couple of idiots. You're wasting our time. Slap on the wrist. Off you go.
Yeah.
But it wasn't. It was, we were arrested on suspicion of human trafficking, which carries a pretty hefty sentence if you do get charged with it. And the officers, they didn't have a clue. I'd already taken my dry suit off at this point. My friend still had his on. And the questions were along the lines of, you've just come from France on that dinghy. Yes. Right. How come you were bone dry and he's in a dry suit, which is soaking wet on the outside? My dry suit was by my feet on the floor. I just pointed it to the police officer. I just pointed to her. I said, because I've just taken my dry suit off. And it was, none of them knew what they were doing. That's why four different agencies turned up. They were all conflabbing with each other about what to do. And they probably haven't experienced something like that before.
So what you've done really is you just exposed it for what
And
it
exactly, you hitting the nail on the head. They were embarrassed. It was, these two have just absolutely had our pants down, and they're taking the mick out of us for it. They're laughing at us.
Yeah, they're trying to do you for something, and you're like, fuck off, mate. Yeah. Look down the road, man.
They were embarrassed. That was definitely a massive part of it, was the fact that they've embarrassed us, they've taken the mick, and they threw the toys out of the pram. We're going to arrest them and mess them around for it. It's quite funny, the Border Force.
I'm going to have a go at this.
I'm going to take you down. The Border Force guy got out. This is quite funny as well. Big, salty old sea dog with his big grey beard. And he was just looking at our deflated dinghy going, you've just come from northern France on that. And we were like, yeah. And he's like, it's 4-7 out there, lads. He said, no wonder you idiots have got across. We're not even sending patrol boats out in these conditions. So, it was quite funny.
It gets frightening out there when there's a bit of a swell on, though, Lee, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And because in the pitch black, they were, it's one of the busiest shipping lanes in the world. So, of course, there's boats coming past us. We can't really get a good bead on how far away they are. Because it's pitch black. You've got no reference of land. And all you see is a light. And you know it's a ship. But you're like, well, how big is that light? And therefore, you don't know how big the light is. You can't get a reference of how far away it is. And it's not until it's then quite close and you're like, whoa, that's quite a close call. Yeah, the swell changed. Initially, it was quite rough when we set off. And like I said, in the dark, you just don't know when there's going to be a big wave come in to hit you and knock you off. So, yeah, it was pretty choppy out there.
Yes. It reminds me of that famous radio conversation. It said, unknown vessel, suggest you get out of our way.
Yeah.
We are the USS Nimitz. We are an enormous aircraft carrier. Cannot change course. And it keeps going back and forward. No, suggest you get out of our way. Finally, it's, we are a lighthouse.
Yeah.
Yes. So, and your writing, Lee, let's cover that because, isn't it? It's a good credit, mate, to the Corps. How many bootnecks end up as authors, isn't it, really?
Yeah, surprising even, yeah.
Yes, I mean, it's, you can do a lot with a set of crayons.
That's American banter, man. That's, I mean, it's the people, the British Navy and that have jumped on that banter. They are Marines, eat crayons. They're like, it's Yank banter. Get your own banter.
Is that Yank banter, really? I thought that was real, true, hardcore bootneck, came out of the Falklands type banter.
Nah, they've stolen that from the Yanks because that's what the US Marines are traditionally known as, crayon eaters. Because they're a lot bigger than the Royal Marines as a unit. Their standards, I would say, are a lot more watered down. What's their initial training? 8 weeks, 12 weeks on Paris Island, something like that. So, yeah, a lot of them, the standards aren't as high as ours. And that's what the US Navy and Army call them, crane eaters.
Yeah,
all the gear and no idea is what we used to say, isn't it? We were the borrowers.
Yeah, but I think the Corps attracts that. I don't want to put the army down or anything like that and say they're dumb or we're not, but I think the Corps does, it attracts people who probably a little bit more mature, as in I joined when I was 23 and I'm glad it did because I knew I wanted to do it. I wasn't joining at 17. I'll test the water, and then when I go and get stuff, you're like, do you know what, sod this. I'd seen a bit of the civvy life. I was a civil servant in DVLA, worked in a warehouse, worked in a factory.
Hang on, Lee, are you saying you joined last year?
I know, it's hard to believe, man. Colour sergeant in a year. Flyer.
Mate,
flyer.
He don't look old enough, does he?
Yeah, I mean, you've only been out for 4 years now, innit?
Why did you guys join up then? Because I tried to join the RAF and they wouldn't have me, which is no surprise, really. I've been rejected quite a lot in my life. And the RAF said, we don't think you'll hack the training. So my mate had just joined the Royal Marines and he was full of it, like, you know, someone is when they've just passed the potential recruits course. And he looked at me, he went, yeah, of course, you couldn't do it, Frawley. I went, oh, yeah, want to bet? And that was literally, so I joined the Marines for a bet. What about like you, Westy?
Yeah, that wasn't my initial thing that got me, but I did have something like that along the way. I joined the careers office. It used to be opposite where I now own a cafe bar in Swansea. So I'm looking at where I actually joined up every day in the business. I went in there to join and they didn't have a Marine in there. They had the Army side and they had the Navy side. So to get into the Navy, it's funny, to get into the Navy side, you had to go through the Army recruitment desk. I remember this big Welsh Guards colour sergeant sat there and he was like, no, you don't want the Marines. Welsh Guards you want, boy, with your own buddies. It's hard, that Marines. No, it was harder getting past him than it was the potential Royal Marines course. So eventually he sends me, he's like, he gave up. Yeah, he really wants the Marines. He sent me next door to see the Navy guy. I remember him, he's Petty Officer, PTI, although it's Navy, it's not real PTI, is he? And he was telling me that I wasn't big enough. He was like, yeah, we'll send you down on the course and that. Your CV levels are good, whatever. You're not big enough. Do you do weights? I said, well, not really. I'll concentrate more on body strength stuff, press-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, what they're telling me to do. He's like, not enough. You need to do weights. You're just not big enough. You haven't got the frame for it. And that was a massive one for me. I was like, well, I'm going to show him as well. It wasn't the reason I got there, but it was an extra thing because I am that sort of stubborn person, like yourself, Chris, wants to prove people wrong. And it was quite nice when I did pass out as the King's Badgeman, brown nose, cocksucker, whatever you want to call him. I went back to the Greer's office to see him. Yeah, and he was like, oh, you passed then? I was like, yeah, King's Badgeman. And you could see the look on his face to say, yeah, I was wrong. So that was quite nice.
So but let's
may not find this, guys, that, you know, if you do a 30-mile of a weight, and it was always, every time you did it, I don't know about you guys, but the big guys seemed to lag the stamina. You know, they were big, muscly guys and all that, you know, and they were pushing on. You get to like 6 miles and they'd start flagging it. And you're like, you know, you are.
Yeah, same with the rope climbing. A lot of the bigger guys up top struggle with the rope climbing, with the agility side of it. But there's, I mean, everybody's got their strengths and weaknesses. You just got to find out all around.
Yeah, I really struggled with in training.
I loved the
salt courses, but on ropes, you use your legs, man. You use your legs. You don't have to do anything. And that's a struggle.
I had no fitness, no stamina, and zero military knowledge. So I can only assume it was my stunning good looks that the Marines were after. And
yes,
thank you very much for that.
Good. Yeah,
standards must have been lower back then, mate. It must have been a lot lower. That's all I can say.
Yeah, I don't know why they made me pass out with a paper bag over my head, but jealous, that's what it was.
Still wearing it, mate. You know you can take it off now.
You know when you join up, you get the gobbiest lads in that first couple of weeks, but it probably changed, Lee, by the time you went through, but when we went through, it was called induction. We are going to brainwash you. Now they call it, what do they call it now?
Freshers Week or something.
Oh, it's like the sissy suite or something, you know. Yeah. It's got pink cushions in there.
And it'll be development or something like that, I imagine.
Yeah. And in that, you rock up there, and it was the first time I'd heard like regional accents. It blew me away. But listen to a Geordie for the first time, like, what the? Are you talking about, mate? And you had these big gobby guys from, I'm going to say, predominantly up north. I know they say, you know, gobby southerners, but you had these Geordies, and they'd all been in the RMR and they all seemed to have more experience than you, and yet they were all the first to go. the cadets as well. We had people that were, you know. I don't know if you can get like warrant officer in the cadets or colour sergeant or something. And you're thinking, oh, this person's, you know, they're definitely down to get a green berry. And they were, you know, the last 2 weeks, and we had this
chance. A lot of the cadets and stuff like that, what I found is they'll do well in the initial stage because they know how to iron, they know how to make the bed, they know basic military drill and stuff like that. So the initial stage where everyone else is on a level, they're above. But at some point then, everyone else starts catching up. And then when it gets to the stuff that they don't know, the more arduous stuff, the more technical things, they're now on the same level playing field as you. And I find then once you catch them up, they start getting left behind, unless they're naturally good at that as well. But some of them who aren't, and they're only really shining because they've got that previous experience. You get to that level playing field. And as you said then, after a few weeks, they start tailing off a little bit.
We had this chap called Napa. I think he was a Geordie from what I remember. And after we did that test on the range where you wear your respirator for the first time, you got to run up and down the range carrying sandbags and all that kind of stuff. Afterwards, we all fell in, respirators off, obviously. And one of the training team just looked at Napa and went, Napa, why have you still got your respirator on? So, I haven't, Corporal. In a Geordie accent, I haven't, Corporal. Oh, and that went on through the whole of training. Napa, take your respirator off, right? The only trouble was it went on all the way through training, and yet Napa didn't make it past week 8.
Don't want to black cat you, as you say, in the core, Chris, but I will. So, of course, everybody gets that joke of the respirator. And then I took that on when I was a corporal, taking recruits through. And it was one lad called Jacko, still great mates with him to this day. I cracked the joke on him. Really strong, tall lad. Had a bit of strong features, probably why I picked the respirator joke on him. So I did it to him, and he was a recruit. I then went on to take him on his corporal's course when I was a sergeant, still cracking the joke at him on his corporal's course. I then went on to be his sergeant in one of the units afterwards, still cracking the same respirator. Throughout his whole career, he just had me stood there giving him this respirator joke. Brilliant.
Yes. What about nicknames then, Kenny, in the army? Is that with the obvious exception of all the, you know, knocker and smudge and all that. Yeah. Is it traditional?
Oh, God, yeah. You had one guy called Gook, and he was a small lad, been in a long time, and Gook was renowned for, let's just say he had a large member. And when we were in Belize and that, he was banned from wearing shorts. You know what I mean? He was banned. He was the only person banned for wearing shorts. But he went AWOL. He went AWOL in, bloody, he was a legend in the battalion. He went AWOL in Canada. And he came back weeks late while we were on exercise. And the CO says to him, like, where have you been, Gook? And he says, well, just look at my face. I'm that ugly. You know what I mean? I don't really get the opportunity to get with a bird, do I? I got the opportunity to go with this last, so I made the most of it. Get out, Goop.
Tell what I loved about nicknames in the Corps, and you must have found this, Chris, was that nothing was off the table. And we had saying in the Corps, there's only one colour that matters, and that's green. You got the green lid. Don't care where you're from, where you've been, what you look like, you've got that same green lid as me. And then the nicknames could be brutal. And I always tell my civvy friends, and they always sort of roll their eyes, is we had a guy, he was a clerk called Black Tony, right? And you say that, and they're like, whoa, we can't. And I say to them, I said, these are nicknames behind people's backs. I got told to go to I joined this unit, go to the company office and report to the clerk and report to Black Tony. So I'm like, all right, so I walk in. I'm looking for Black Tony. Yeah, over here, mate. Come over. Why'd they call you Black Tony, Tom? Well, we got a White Tony. So to save the confusion, I'm Black Tony. And he'd introduce himself to other people. Somebody was, oh, hi, mate, I'm John or whatever. Oh, yeah, Black Tony. And that's what I loved about the nicknames. There was nothing was off the table and nobody got offended by him.
Hey, it's New Year's Eve, isn't it? So I'm going to pick this day to announce our big plan for next year. And that is rowing across the Atlantic.
Oh, sweet.
Yes. And so at present, it's myself, a fellow Royal Marine I was in training with, Chrissy, who's been on the podcast as a co-host recently. Chrissy has got an army background. And I've just got a second Royal Marine interested, absolutely top lad called Sean. And we thought we'd... How can I say this? We thought rather than focus on the traditional charities that everybody does, and I think it's a bit of a crime, really, that you know, the taxpayer and the good, hardworking people of this country have to put their hands in their pockets to pay for the charities for servicemen. I think it you know, that should be something that the government pay for, but that's another thing. So at the moment, we're looking at raising money for a charity that supports children who lost a parent or parents. I'm hoping it's just a parent in conflict. And also sheltered housing for veterans who've been homeless, who probably got substance misuse issues and the like. And a charity that gets them into housing. So for the benefits of people at home, I'll show you. This is the logo that I've been working on all morning. This is my Photoshop, the limit of my Photoshop skills, but you are the first to see this. And it is by no... Well, you can see it's not even like finished, but there we go. We thought we'd call ourselves Ocean's Elite as a bit of a play on Ocean's 11. And because three of us are from the commandos, and there we go, folks. If you want to follow us, I've set the social media up, although I haven't put any logos on, as you can see, because I haven't finished it yet. But we're going to be Ocean's Elite Row all across the board. So stay tuned for that one.
I'm gonna take that off for that.
Yeah, do you just have to? study navigation, obviously.
No, I'm going to do what Westy did and just go for it.
Pin the Empire State Building. Empire State Building, let's go.
It's
Why am I in Jamaica?
Well,
who's rowing?
On a more serious note, I've been on expeditions when people have, you know, lost their lives, and it fucking, excuse my French, but it is safety first. You've got to be skilled to cope with any eventuality, haven't you? When you're thousands of miles from land and probably hours and hours from any sort of rescue. I mean, I'm guessing mid-Atlantic, you've got to hope that there's a ship nearby, haven't you? And even then, that doesn't mean they can get you, because some ships are not equipped to come and pick up the occupants of a rowing boat.
What's the crack, Richard? If you did hit, say, a massive storm, is it just oars in on them things? Because obviously there's two of you and two in the back. Is there a way of like pulling the oars in, battening down and putting the canopy up and having like a cocoon, and then you just ride it out?
I would say you'd bring the oars in, you'd bolt them down with the G clamps that are already, or the clamps that are already on board. You chuck in the drogue anchor or the sea parachute so that the boat doesn't get twisted side on to the waves. And then you'd batten down the hatches, mate, get in the cabin. There's two cabins on board, one at either end. One of them, I'm told, is usually full of equipment. But,
hold on and ride it out.
Yeah, this is all the sort of stuff. I mean, I did our Royal Yachting Association, isn't it? RYA. I did the powerboat course, which sounds really mental, doesn't it? It sounds like you're on one of them big racing machines, but powerboat is anything with an engine. So what Lee crossed the channel in counts as a powerboat.
People would be writing off, he had a powerboat. Well, an achievement.
And so I did that. I'll tell you a funny dit, actually. Well, it's not hilarious. Don't you know, strap yourselves down or anything. But when I was on that course, and it was a good course, you know, you cover radio procedure, tides, weather condition, how to park or berth the boat and all this sort of stuff. One of the questions they said is, if it's at night and you're out in the ocean, i.e. you're not alongside, you've chucked an anchor in, how do you know if you're drifting on the anchor, like you're dragging the anchor? And no one put their hand up except me, because the sea runs in my blood. And I said, well, you chuck another anchor in with a buoy on it. And he just like looked at me, and I thought, oh shit, well, what have I said? He just looked at me and said, who told you that? I said, well, I just thought it was obvious. He says, in all the 30 years I've been doing this course, no one has ever got that question right. So, but yes. I mean, I went on expedition to Antarctica, and when we were scuba diving, one of the dive team drowned, and it was a bit fucking messy, you know. So, yes, all safety will be paramount. Safety and fun, Kenny. You know, it's.
You know when you obviously you've got to keep have you got an outboard on it just in case?
No,
it, so,
well, it right. wouldn't do you any. I mean, the only possible use for an outboard would be if you did get bad weather and you kept getting turned side onto the waves. You probably get a bit more maneuverability with an outboard to quickly, you know, sort of straighten you up again. That and being in harbour. Getting into, you know, pulling into the marina and getting a berth. But I've done that already. I've been out on the boat. It's not too...
Has it got a sea compass on it? So you just can both sit there and just watch it and just say, right, stay on up there. And, yeah, left a bit, right a bit. There's it. Do you know what I mean? Or
yes.
Is it GPS? You can just look at it all the time and go, oh, shit, going off a bit. Which would be a pain in the ass, wouldn't it? Because you'd be rowing for nothing.
Yeah, it's
having it all the way across the bloody channel, the ocean.
Set off from Liverpool, end up in Portsmouth.
Yeah,
it just better not be like that compass on what was it, Pirates of the Caribbean, the one he's got, and it just points wherever it wants to. Yeah. Yeah, I think you have a compass in front, like, you know, screwed to the outside of the cabin, so you're facing it. I'd imagine you don't. Well, you would have GPS on board as well, but the compass is just so you.
Yeah, belt and the brace, isn't it? If the GPS goes down, you gotta go mark one compass.
Yeah.
West. Keep west. Keep west.
And the person in front has got steering pedals with their feet, so you can sort of, you can keep on course. Yeah.
Oh, so it's like, so there's four of you. There's two of you doing it. It's say four on four off or something, rowing. So the ones that are rowing, are they steering as well? Are you steering it as well as you're rowing?
Yes, you are. It all sounds a bit much, doesn't it? But yeah, you have to keep on that bearing. And if you think about it, the mileage that you end up doing is probably way more than it would be if it was a straight line on the map, because you're going to be zigzagging, you're going to be blown off course.
It's like a marathon, isn't it? You never do 26.2 or whatever it is. You always do a lot more because you're meandering and
also crawling.
Yeah,
dodging waterfalls.
Exactly.
What's the route? First of all, I got to take my hat off to you, mate, because I love a mental challenge, as you probably tell, from Channel Crossing and running marathons after living homeless, cycling to London. But that's one thing I've never even considered doing, not like the rowing the Atlantic stuff. I'm not great, like you said, out in the middle of the Atlantic, and you're like, shit, if we do get turned side on, I'm not great with the ocean, to be honest with you. But yeah, just the routine. I'm interested in what the routine would be like. Resting, rowing, talking shit. Because I'm going to imagine it's going to have to be, you're going to have that backed up for when it gets tough and you're bored and you're getting a bit threaders with each other. Like, there's going to have to be somebody to pull out the bag to talk some shit or tell some jokes what routine would it be throughout that?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that, because I'm like you, Lee. I'm like all ears when it comes to anything like this. I just want to know what, where, how, why, when, how much it costs, what you're going to do, what music you're going to listen to, what you're going to eat, how you're going to cook, this is why I started my podcast, believe it or not, is I just wanted to spin dits about traveling around the world and learning to fly and skydiving and, you know, camping out in the Amazon jungle with nothing but a machete I found in the jungle, funny enough. I thought people would lap that stuff up, and yet it's hard to get hold with that sort of content. It was only when I started talking about, I just started spinning a few dits about my Marines training, and then whoa, the subscriber count just starts rocketing up. So I'm glad you asked, Matt, because this is the sort of conversation I started the podcast for. Traditionally, it's 2 hours on, 2 hours off.
How can you do that? I mean, it's bad enough four on, four off.
Well, I guess during the night time, if you staggered it slightly, it might be possible to say someone at least gets 3 hours or even four, because 4 hours isn't bad kip, is it?
Is that because of muscle fatigue?
I think it's just a combination of everything. Obviously, you harden to the rowing as you go along, don't you? You know, you're sort of tough. It's like, I don't know, you just harden to it. It's a lot of stuff. You know, you're going to get chafing, you're going to get blisters, you're going to get the equivalent of trench foot, but like on your ass and this kind of stuff. And I'm just be interested to see what routines other people have worked. Traditionally, like I said, it's 2 hours on, 2 hours off. But by the time you've got off, had a cup of tea, maybe had something to eat, that's not a lot of time to grab a kit. On the other hand, if someone stayed on for 4 hours, which sounds a long time, but you got to remember, we might not be racing for England. You know what I mean? We might do it. We haven't got that far in our mission sort of statement yet about, do we want to go for a record or do we want to kind of chill and enjoy the experience? But if you could do 4 hours straight, obviously then that means that people could have 4 hours off, couldn't they? I can't really think of it in my head, but I don't know. It's between 40 and 60 days, that's a long time to be doing 2 hours on, 2 hours off.
And if somebody gets an injury, do you know what I mean? It's like, fucking hell. If they pull a muscle or something, it's, oh, shit. You know what I mean? There's loads can go wrong. Like, mind you, if the women have done it, you can do it. You know what I mean?
Oh, is he allowed to say that?
Kenny,
here's the thing. I know I'm going to say it, right? How do you have a number two and a number one?
Can we just cover the racism issue, please? We'll have no racism on my show, Kenny. Women are just as good as men, okay? Have you ever seen them in the kitchen? They're fucking brilliant, mate.
We're going to get shut down for this, not bloody Irish kids with guns.
Yeah, would you have a blanket, Chris, if you want to go for number two overboard?
Friends at home, we are obviously joking.
Are you going to be like that? Hang on a minute, I need to go to the toilet.
Kenny, he's going to have a TV made, they're going to have Sky Sports on it. They'll be listening to all this hardship, they're going to have sores on their asses or whatever. They're going to be living in luxury, mate.
Yeah, you got a big, long Perspex tube, and two of your oppos steady you like that, and you can guess where the tube goes. All right, I can't be too graphic. We've already been taken off air once today, and then you point the tube over the side, and it's a bit like your rats escaping I don't want to say a sinking ship because that's bad luck, but then you can direct it then so it doesn't land in the boat. That's what I've been told anyway.
It's fine. It's like anything, isn't it? If you thinking of that now, people are going, oh my God, that's disgusting. And you go to Glastonbury. If you look at a photo of the toilets at Glastonbury before you go, you're like, no way am I going in there. As soon as you're there and you're six cans of Strongbow deep and covered in mud, you're in there. I mean, as soon as you can. So you just adapt and just get on with it.
Yes. to be honest, I think there's a couple of ways to do it. Obviously, you can just go in a bucket in the cabin or on the deck. There's not a lot of room on deck. When there's two people rowing, there isn't really room. The other two, if they want to be on deck, they have to sit on the cabin roof, so to speak. But you could just crouch down on the bucket, or you can hang your ass overboard, give yourself a bit of a spruce up with the old... Eastern style with a scoop.
Natural B-Day.
Yeah, the old natural B-Day.
After 40 days, it would have a nice brown stripe down the side of the ring, wouldn't it?
You'd have a right sore hoop.
Yeah, we probably won't be rowing that fast, can he? But
three Marines alone for 40 days, you might have sore hoops anyway, other than the salty sea.
Well, now we're definitely going to get taken down. Yeah, it's fascinating, though, Lee, isn't it? These kind of things, you know. It's the minutiae just fascinates me.
Just my update. Yeah.
Kenny, don't go touching your phone again. We don't want to lose you.
Yes.
Last time there was an accident with a coffee table, wasn't there?
Yes.
You don't want to go to A&E, Westy, with a coffee table stuck up your ass. Kenny will tell you.
I think with these challenges, Chris, like you said, is I'd shy away for something like this, but I'm that stubborn. It probably would take for someone to say to me, you couldn't do it. Like you said, with people saying you couldn't join the Marines, somebody said to me, you couldn't row across the Atlantic. I'd be begging you for a spot on that boat, probably.
Well, the thing is, right, my mind don't work like that at all. I'm always, do I want to do it? Well, yeah. Is it the chance, you know, sort of chance of a lifetime thing? Yeah. Has somebody else done it? Yeah. Well, then I can do it. I mean, I'm being realistic. I mean, I can't run 100 metres in 8.9 seconds or whatever they do. But if...
Yeah, no, it's not Mission Impossible.
If you're average, you know, there's a lot of very, let's just say regular people have rowed across the Atlantic. It's also, Lee, it's, you know, again, I've don't want to sound bloody jinx myself, but statistically it's quite safe, you know. You've got the biggest flotation device, you know, and you're strapped, as long as you're strapped to it in bad weather, you're not.
Well, it is a life raft, really, isn't it?
Yeah, they're self-righting as well, so they flip themselves up, so it's not like it could be upside down. And I mean, that has happened. That happened. Mick Dawson, who's a former Royal Marine, Falklands veteran, friend of mine, been on the podcast. He was the first person to row across the Atlantic across the Pacific with a gentleman called Chris Marshall. It's Chris that's in charge of our expedition. I say in charge. He provides all the logistics and the weather and everything and the boat. What am I saying? Yeah, Mick on his first attempt. Mick and Chris were the first two to row the Pacific. They rowed from Japan to the Golden Gate Bridge, literally went under the Golden Gate Bridge. It's an incredible book. If anyone likes good adventure books, get Mick Dawson's book. It's absolutely just brilliant. I got the audio book. Mick capsized on his first attempt in the Pacific on his own. The boat didn't right. It was kind of flopped over at an angle. So he was in the cabin and the bottom third of the cabin was full of water. And he was there for 3 days wondering whether his EPIRB, so his emergency beacon, whether it was giving off a signal, even though it was in the cabin. What you got to do is get them wet and then they automatically start signaling as though, you know, heaven forbid, something's happened to your vessel. He didn't know if it would work in the confines of the cabin, whether the radar signal would be strong enough. So he had to make the decision, I need to get outside. And knowing full well, as soon as he opened the cabin door, all the water would rush in. And he did it. He got hooked up as he was trying to get out, so he couldn't get out from under the water. Lost all his memory stick with all his photos of the trip, all the video. And then he was clinging to the outside of his boat for something like 12 hours in the drink, waiting for a vessel to come and pick him up. The vessel came. Obviously, it made one pass and they threw over a life raft and the life raft just whizzed away in the wind, got whisked away. So that wasn't any good. Then he had to wait for the boat to come back a second time and just make the dishes and right, go for it and grab the rope that they chucked him down. But I think the boats are self-right. Well, I know the boats are self-righting now.
That'd be all right then. That would be all right. That'd be a book in my mind, that.
Yeah, and I'll be absolutely like bootneck strictness with one of the best tents I went in Norway. Was a corporal called Mac, and all of him and his half of the section had everything squared away in their tent all the time, and not just squared away. He insisted that everything was like Globe and Laurel with your, you know, with your gloves like resting on top. It was quite impressive to see. Our tent was, it wasn't a bag of shit or anything, but we weren't really that, you know, we left the cookers out and all this sort of stuff. And I just remember thinking, bloody hell, I mean, this guy, he took his field craft really seriously. And I think if you're in bad weather, you got to have everything stowed away, haven't you? Because if it's not, you got to be prepared to lose it. And if it's something that you can't,
you're going to suffer. Yeah, you're going to suffer.
Yes.
Like the Arctic, if you don't put your gloves away and they frost up, you're knackered. You can't do anything with them.
It's a funny thing. I mean, I was talking to our locals platform, our locals video platform the other morning. I do a private stream some mornings. And I was just saying, you know, one thing in life, don't let other people talk you out of your goals, because I believe in getting advice from everybody, but I've done this long enough now that I know a lot of that advice is going to be negative and it's going to try and talk me out of what I want to do. And it's going to come from people who may already have done it, or people that are way more competent than I am.
You don't want to lose your focus. Yeah.
When I ran the length for the UK, I got told you're mental, it can't be done. I've spoken to my mate. He's a professional ultra runner, one of the world's top runners. He said it's physically impossible. You'd have to have this, dirt, dirt. You'd have to do, you know, you probably have to, a culmination of 10 years of training. I did no training. I think I ran 3 miles around the block and I had a little 9 mile bimble on holiday. That was it. And I put on a 15 kilo backpack. Mm-hmm. I'd been in hospital for a spine operation recently. And, pointed my compass south and I just started running, and it was best day of my life. I was loving it. I had no doubt that I wasn't going to give up. Do you know what I mean? So I say, what do they say? Love everybody, trust a few, but always paddle your own canoe.
Nice saying.
I think you're right with the spot on from what I've seen with that, Chris, with the advice. Found it a lot, not just with challenges, but in business, especially trying to drag a business through COVID and then coming up with ideas when I came out the other side of COVID, okay, well, everything's still struggling now, being closed and in and out of lockdowns. What do I need to do to expand and try and bring a little bit more revenue in, try something outside of the norm from the business? And a lot of people, like you're saying, they've either done it themselves or attempted it or maybe looked at it. And I just found a lot of it was, it's not worth it. I had a go at it and it's not worth it. The market's flooded or there's not enough scope for it. And it was just so negative. It was where, I don't know what their thought process is, whether they didn't want to then be jealous if they saw you accomplish it when they couldn't, or whether that's just something ingrained in them naturally, where they're just naturally negative about somebody trying to do something else. And I found a lot of it especially through the business part of coming the other side of COVID. Whenever I come up with an idea or a venture, there was definitely more negative advice or leanings towards me than it was positive.
Yes, it's that's it.
And you got to, like you said, you got to ignore it. Sometimes you got to go, well
people judge you on their own fears.
You couldn't do it. Yeah.
People judge you on their own fears, don't they?
Yeah.
Also, people, when they're scared, it's like they make this parallel that they think because they're scared or they're nervous that everyone else is useless as well. And then they start looking like that. You see it when people are being instructed for, say someone's getting instructed how to snowboard and they haven't got any confidence in themselves. They just start looking around at what everyone else is doing when what they should be doing is listening to the freaking instructor who knows what they're talking about. And it's funny, these little quirks of human nature that you sort of learn over the years. Yes. Westy, how's the writing going? I've been flashing up your book cover. Now and again, we were saying, weren't we? I can't remember if I said it in this podcast or the one that got cancelled, but quite a few Marines go on to become, good authors.
Yeah. One of the lads I've just taken through, I took through recruit training. He's just released a book, Craig Bob Ainsworth, The Discombobulated Alpha. So he's just brought out a book as well. And like you said, there's a lot of us out there.
Hey, that's a great word, isn't it? Discombobulated.
Yeah. Especially with the Bob, because his nickname's Bob. So combobulated, which I'm sure he picked that for that reason as well.
I managed to get that word in my first memoir. I just loved it. Discombobulated. I think it's more
just had a shoehorn it in somewhere. Yes. It really fits, but I'm getting it in.
Yeah. It's not hard for an ex-Marine, though, is it, to use the word discombobulated? It's how you are most of the time.
Yeah, exactly. It's going good. Yeah.
Sorry, mate, go on.
Yeah, so I've got four published. So three of them are the Tramp Face series, so in the same vein as the Channel Crossing. It's just the three. I've done five. The Channel Crossing was the fifth Tramp Face adventure. So three of them are books at the minute. I've just started writing the fourth one. So I've got that to finish before then doing the Channel Crossing one, which I'm really looking forward to. But you got to stick to the order. I can't do that one before I've done the fourth. And then the main one, which is my autobiography, that's all out. It's been released since May last year. And I'm now dabbling into the audiobook world. So I've built a makeshift studio in my house. I live on my own. So apart from the dog, it's quite easy to do that and have peace and quiet. I'm going to start turning them all into audiobooks as well.
Yeah, that is my New Year resolution. I put it off now for 3-4 years, man, and it's like no, I'm gonna it's gonna be equal priority to the podcast.
And it's just a huge market for it as well now. If you are going into the author sphere, as they say, and you're not doing audio, you're missing out on a massive portion. And I know what the exact figures are, but a rough sketch of what I read into it was only between 5-10%, I think it's just 5% of all the books published have been turned into audiobooks. So only 5% of all those books you're competing with as a written author are actually you're going to compete against as an audio author, if that's the word, a narrator. And not only is the portion of all written books made into audio so small, the market for audiobooks is just growing exponentially. So that market is thirst for it. Everybody's too busy to sit down and read a book. They're listening to them in the van while they're cleaning the house. Well, some people have got jobs which involve they can listen to things. So many people have got an appetite for these audiobooks now. And the actual amount of them that's out there is so small. So it's a massive opportunity to, if you've got books written, to turn them into audiobooks. So that's what I'm doing as well.
What were they about? Well, Steve, what was your first one? And that what were they all about?
So they're Tramp Fist. The very first one was myself and my friend. We decided to go and live on the streets of Swansea for 7 nights homeless. And we didn't want to do it like you see reporters and politicians. They go and spend it like homeless. Everybody knows who they are. Everybody knows what they're doing. You don't get the real story. You speak to somebody, they give you the story they want you to hear. So, well, let's go undercover. We'll dress. We'll have to beg every day. We'll sleep rough. And we had a cover story. We're ex-forces on the streets, which is a very believable story, of course, and try to find our feet. So then we could mingle with the other homeless people, with all the services as well, to see what help is out there, and the general public. We had to beg, again, under the guise of just being homeless. We had to find somewhere to live and interact with everything for a week as a homeless person. And then, of course, see what happens every day. So that was the first book.
Is the drugs rife, like? Is drugs really rife on the homeless scene?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a massive part of it. And not all of them. We found there was different categories of the people we come across. We saw some people who were just temporarily homeless. They've had a bit of bad luck. They've split up with a partner, whatever it is. And they're just on the streets because they've got nowhere at the minute, but they're trying to engage, and eventually they're going to get help and get out of it.
Yeah.
You get other ones who are there, and they're sort of, they're fleeting, they're in and out. They get housed, they can't cope with getting back into society and the stress of it, and they turn back to drink or drugs or crime. Yeah. You get kicked out, they end up back on the streets, or they're in and out of jail as well. So you get those ones who sort of bouncing.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Bouncing between it, and then you get the other ones who are sort of long-term homeless. And you say they're homeless. A lot of the people we interacted with weren't sleeping on the streets every day. They had somewhere, a hostel or a flat or a residence, but they still attracted to that circle of street life, if you like, hanging around on the streets, doing drugs, crime. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the hard drug abusers, heroin, stuff like that, we found most of them were quite unsavory. And when they needed something because of their addiction, they would get it, whichever way they could. But yeah, drinking drugs were very prominent.
Well, hard. My best friend way back, he joined the army with me. My best friend, he actually lived in a skip when he got out of the army. He was eating chips off the freaking floor and that. Yeah, just totally disbanded. Fuck off. You know, you're out, ta-ra now. And it took him years to get on his feet, but now he works as a one-stop place in Liverpool where you get all the veterans in and they clothe them, they sort them out with white goods, they send them to all the different charities and that. They've got all that channel. They can give them anything. And he walked me through it level by level. Food, shoes, jeans, T-shirts, have something, clothe them, get them accommodation, get them white goods. He says, but some people you can help, but you just can't help. Do you know what I mean? Like one guy there, he said, he was begging on Liverpool Lime Street, right? And 500 quid a day, 500 quid begging. And he helped him out and he got him housing and everything. And then he turned around and he says, what the frigging hell's going on? Like, he got him a job and all sorts. And he just up sticks and fuck it off.
And that's the problem with
the station. Yeah, went back down the station, said, what the frigging hell are you doing? Like, I've done all this for you. Get more money. You know? And that was it. You can't help some people.
And that's the mindset you got to get out of. A lot of people try and oversimplify the homeless situation. You see it all the time in the media. Everyone that's homeless is just poor, down on their luck, and needs money thrown at it and accommodation thrown at it, and it'll solve it. It isn't going to solve it. Because the title of my first book was called Homeless by Choice. A double meaning. One, that we chose to go and live homeless for a week to see it, and one that a lot of people, which causes controversy, choose to live that life, I think. Maybe Suella Braverman might have said it, I think, recently. Slated straight away. And it's like, look, on the outset of that statement, you could say, there'd be uproar, of course. But you've got to look into it. And some people do. She's not saying that everyone, well, I'm not saying everyone that's on the streets is there by choice. But some people are. They do choose that lifestyle.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, like you said, you could try and help them. And at some point, you got to go to tough love and go, it's happened this week with a veteran has been coming into my bar for help. He's thrown it all back in our faces. And at some point, you've got to go, well, I hate getting to that point where I go, I can't help him anymore. But you've got to get to a point where you go, I can't just keep helping him as I have been helping him. Yeah. You've now got to give him a bit of tough love and go, we've given you as much help as we can. You're not accepting it. So now you've got to start taking responsibility. You've got to start helping yourself. because otherwise you're going to go through life always relying on other people. And that's not helping them out as much as it's not helping the situation.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not helping them. You've got to give them that emphasis. I took something flashed up on my social media this week. Yesterday, last year, I took a young guy in. He came into the bar asking for help because we support a homeless in the city. And he'd been split up with his missus, apparently, and he was homeless. So I put him, I have a studio at the back of my house, like a studio flat, a bed set, granny annex, whatever you want to call it. It was empty. So I said to him, look, I'll put you in there. You can move there now. It's got power and everything. It needs a little bit of upkeep and decorating. He was a handyman. I said, how about you do those jobs? I'll give you the tools. I'll pay for the paint and all the rest of it. You can live there. And the predicament he was in was the council would give him housing support and benefit, but they didn't have any to give him, so he had to find it on the private market. So therefore, you've got to find a month up front, yeah, a bond, which he didn't have. So I said, I will waive that for you and the month's rent. I'll give you the contract. You can take it to the council, get registered, and in 6 weeks' time, when they start paying you it, because you've got a contract in the place, then start paying you it. Happy days. Did that for him, put a brand new boiler in there, gave him a bike, even bought him a week's worth of food shopping. And long story short, he ended up owing me over £1,000, stopped paying the rent to me. I eventually went back in there because he wasn't replying, and he trashed the place. I got the photos and the videos of it. Absolutely trashed it. He's now getting chased by the council and trading standards. He's been ripping people off from jobs. Mm-hmm. And you're like, I give him all that help. He had everything. He was back on his feet, somewhere to live, a job.
Yeah.
And he just, they throw it back at you. So it's a difficult one.
Mm-hmm.
With the giving the support out, which you still do, and this week is a veteran as well. Because everyone just think, oh, veterans are just holier than thou, and you mean great. Like, not all of them are. Same as any walk of life, homeless, drug addicts, veterans, whatever. Politicians, there's good ones and there's bad ones. And it's hard to decipher when you're giving that help and that support out, which one is which. So I've had to take a step back now and stop doing blanket support, because people will take the mick from. And then it takes away from the people who do actually need that support. So I've got a better approach now of having to really delve into it and do my homework on people before I just start giving them blanket support.
Yeah,
it's getting them back into it, and it's getting them back into that. I don't know. I mean, they are trying to do the ID thing, aren't they? If you have the veteran's ID, like your MOD form 90, so it gives them sort of like an attachment, you know, when they're out.
Yeah.
Give them this and give them that, rail cards. I mean, I've got a rail and stuff, you know, why not? But the thing with, like, Help for Heroes, I had to go to the Colonel down, and they've shut it down now. They had the old barracks there where I was. I knew where it was. I went in with Brett, the guy from Liverpool. He went up there. I met him there, went in, and it had all the facilities for, like, disabled veterans. Had beautiful accommodation. They'd done it. It'd been a load of money. And I said to this Colonel, yeah, but you're going round and you're at the service stations with bloody disabled bloody veterans begging the public for money. What's that all about? Why are you tugging the heartstrings of the public for bloody money for these guys? They're not heroes. They're just freaking victims of the government, you know? And it angered me. And this colonel was like, whoa. He buggered off when I started having a go, because I had my veterans T-shirt on, Veterans for Peace and that. And I was like, oh, he's met the wrong person here. But I do understand. You've got to give them something to do. Get them away from it. Do what I do. Like, do the woodwork. Craft. Get into
it. Well, let me just interrupt as a substance misuse specialist. Let's not forget, folks, they're self-medicating for pain.
Yeah.
And that pain comes from deep down childhood trauma, being raped, sexually abused, physically, you know, knocked unconscious as toddlers. And people will do anything to numb that pain because they can't deal with it, especially as the pain spirals more, the more you try to numb it, the more the come down just gets worse and worse. So you're forever chasing to stop the pain. Yeah. And I was just showing people at home here the stages of change model, which I'd advise anyone, whoever you are, to get familiar with this model, because this was two social scientists called Prochaska and Dick Clemente that worked out that every human being changes for the same reason. Essentially, it's when the pain of the lifestyle and the inconvenience becomes more, i.e. outweighs the behaviour. So, I mean, and I'm a good example of that, because when I was at my worst with addiction, I couldn't really go any further down. And when I had an epiphany one day and realised just how far I had gone down, it was like, oh, Chris, what have you done, you knob? It all started out as fun in the beginning, and then it become a coping mechanism, then it become habit, then it become I don't know what. And as everything spiraled down, I fortunately got to a place where it was that like sort of wake up call. And I'm lucky I can use that experience now for the greater good, and I obviously wouldn't change it for the world, which is what a lot of people who haven't been down that path don't understand, is these things are sent you to challenge you for a reason, to become a better person. What Prochaska and Dick Clementi said is they said that when you're in that denial phase, you think, you know, you whatever it is, hammering down a bottle of vodka a day or smoking a pipe or whatever it is, you're in pre-contemplation. Like, you just think that behavior, that's what you need to do to numb your pain. And then the day comes around where you start contemplating, hang on, is this behavior actually doing me any good anymore? And then people become determined and think, do you know what? I think I need to change. And then they take action. And here's quite an interesting thing. You'll maintain that action like anyone, like giving up smoking, giving up chocolate, trying to give up caffeine, all the same, don't matter if it's crack or whatever. You'll maintain it and you'll be in that honeymoon period where you're like, yes. And as soon as you get a bit of stress in your life, your psychological programming, your learned addictive behavior kicks in and goes, oh, you could just have a beer now and get rid of that stress. You could just have a coffee, pick yourself up a bit, whatever. And that's called relapse.
That's exactly what happened to me, Chris. We spoke about it on the podcast in my drinking phase. When COVID hit, I just left the Marines. The business was closed to live on my own. And it was exactly what you said. It was, I'd drink myself to oblivion, end up in hospital. I'd come out of hospital and go, right, this can't happen, sort it out. And for a month, 2 months in some cases, I'd be on form. I'd be training again, focusing, not drinking, whatever. And for me, like you said, we all have our triggers or whatever you want to call that habitual thing that sends you back to, well, traditionally, when this happens, I have a drink. And that's what happens, whether it's stress or you're feeling good because you've accomplished a job, I'll reward myself and have a drink. Mm-hmm. And big one for me was sleep or boredom. I'd get back to the house and I'd be sat here, don't watch a lot of movies or TV. And I'd be like, right, it's a few hours till bedtime. Traditionally a bad sleeper. How am I going to get to sleep tonight? And what am I going to do before I have to try and go to sleep? And then for me, it was just like, well, I'll have a drink because that's what I do when I'm bored. And or if I want to go to sleep, I'll get drunk and then I'll pass out, which actually obviously makes it worse. He sleeps worse and all the rest of it. So that's exactly what it was for me. Is it that cycle of going back to what you habitually did involved having a drink to solve it, whether that was, like you said, memories or the pain of something, and it just kept on reoccurring.
Yes. The good thing
I've
is, so
all, when, yeah, Chris, when, I've been through it all, mate, and the way I got around it, so it's a mindset. It's mindset. I've been split up with my wife. My girls have left me. Obviously, they're older. Been on my own, been in the house on my own, kicking around, thinking, what the hell am I doing? They met Heather, and then we've started to build it back up again. But in that period, it was like you think, what the fuck am I doing? Do you know what I mean? I've struggled all these years looking after kids and, you know, building a home and all that for all to be just taken away. Boom, gone. No wife, no kids. Everything's gone. You're on your own. And I was like, so low. But then you just turn it round. You just turn it fucking round. You just stop. Get out of that mindset. It's a mindset, isn't it? It's like when we were stood in the woods, Chris, and you said, Kenny, what are you smoking for? And I was like, and you're thinking, because Heather does, and it's a habit. It's not good, mate. And I know it's not good. And then all of a sudden, it's like, you know.
Mate, having the odds.
I can have that in front of me. I'm not even fucking bothered anymore. I've been stopped 3 months and I don't give a shit. It's a mindset. Switch it off. Get your inner self tuned into something and just fucking don't take anything seriously anymore. I don't get stressed. I do not get stressed anymore. because I know it's just, you know, the next day you're going to be like,
getting stressed out, Kenny. What are you on about?
Don't get stressed. I just rant and rave, but I don't get, do you know what I mean? I don't get fucking, yeah, you bastards, you know, this, I couldn't give a shit. Don't give a toss. But yeah. Just a, stop. Don't quit. Stop. Just stop. Quitting is not the way ahead. You're quitting. You're just psychologically, it's not working because you'll creep back into it. You've got to stop. You know, fuck that. Move on to there. I got to smash the gym again the new year. I've been meaning to go for months. I was fitter. 2 years ago, I was fitter in my fit. You know, I just turned 50 then than I was in my bloody 20s. Proper fit. Do you know what I mean? I was toned. I was like, what the hell?
Army boys know what a gym is, yeah? They have their army camps.
No, I'm on my bike every day. Do you know what I mean? I'm smashing it. I'm all right.
This is a picture of Kenny's new life, folks. This is his new sober life. Look, this is his new look. Hey, Kenny, I fancy you in that picture, mate. I like the long blonde hair suits you. It's a funny one. It's very easy to get one dimensional about it, isn't it, and forget that, you know, we're talking about human beings here. I remember I got shitty with someone on Facebook once, back in them days where I used to get shitty with people on social media. And it was because they said, oh, these fucking, you know, drug users, they get help from the... the thing was, but people on getting treatment for cancer don't get nothing. And I was like, well, hang on, you know, you can reframe that and say that problematic substance users who were battered as kids or abused, they didn't really ask for that, did they? You know, they didn't ask to grow up as adults self-medicating. You know, that trauma stays with you for life. Whereas cancer is a Western lifestyle disease based off adult life choices. So you can kind of juxtapose the two, like you can put anything, can't you, in a different frame of reference is what I'm trying to say.
Of course you could. People looked at my drinking, which was destructive in those short blasts, but a lot of judgment from people who drink a couple of bottles of wine a night constantly.
Yeah.
So you're like, yeah, all right, what I was doing in that short space of time was very harmful and destructive and frowned upon. But there's a lot of other things out there which are normalized in Western society, like drinking a bottle of wine a night. That don't get frowned upon. So, there's definitely different ways of framing things, Chris.
Yeah.
Think on this evening, New Year's Eve and all that, people.
Yeah.
Think about it in the morning when you're going, oh, this is not right. All these chemicals I've just shoved down my throat. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I wouldn't lecture anyone. I did it for probably 30, 35 years. Yeah. I was off my head, but...
Yeah, my business depends on it, Kenny. So calm down. You're going to put me out of business, mate.
Yeah, Lee's
got... You know what I mean? You get the older you get, you think back and you think, God, I got fucking hammered all them time. What the hell, Mark, was I doing back then? But then you got your kids now. They go out and they get so fucking wasted.
Well, I've seen a big change in that, to be honest, in the bar. And, for example, tonight, New Year's Eve, I'm not expecting... a massively busy night, as you'd traditionally expect back in our day, being oldies. Yeah. New Year's Eve was huge. You'd be queuing to get in every ticketed everywhere. Everything would be double price. Last couple of years, wherever you can blame COVID a little bit for it as well, it's not been the same. But not just New Year's Eve, Boxing Day just gone. It's always traditionally a massive booze in my time. It was like a normal Tuesday. It was dead. Christmas Eve, nothing. And a lot of the younger generation, I love to say it, are shying away from the booze, and there's massive health benefits in that, crime benefits. But with everything yin and yang, there's a downside to it, and mental health is skyrocketing more with the younger generation than it was. Is that because there's a lot more awareness of it? Yes. But also, is that because of the social interaction? When back in my day, at the end of the week, to catch up on what Jono had done on his holiday, what Heath had done when he split up with the missus, and so in his job, you'd have to go down the pub, you'd buy a pint, you'd have a chat about it, you catch up, you tell some crap jokes, and go through it all. And that was your socialising, whereas now they don't need to do that, of course, because they know what they're doing every minute of the day through social media. And I'm not slagging off social media or smartphones, anything like that. There's a lot of benefits to it. I'm just saying this is one of the reasons why that's changing. And is it a downside of them not going out? And drinking was a byproduct of the socializing. We went down the pub to socialize, and drinking came with it. And then we just got used to drinking, and it was a habit that when you socialize.
Now, actually, they just get on the phone, they go tippy tappy, and a bottle of wine will be on your door in half an hour.
Yeah. So there's a massive culture change, and like I said, there's a lot of benefits to it. There's going to be a lot of downsides to it as well. But it is what it is. We've got to embrace it, and it'll be, I mean, the human society evolves and changes.
Got to make it work for ourselves, haven't we?
Yeah.
Speaking of changing, the immigration thing now, the Ethiopians kicking off there in London. What's your thoughts?
I don't know anything about that, to be honest with you. You two will have to gen me up on it.
They all kicked off this morning about something happening in their country, but they're kicking off in London. The Met are handling it in a way that's touchy-feely. So I think they're Ethiopians. They're all coming at them with sticks, a big bloody sticks, whacking the hell out of the Met. And the Met are just stood there going, oh, well, they don't want to do anything, you know what I mean? Because they don't want to be seen to be like...
Yeah, well, my overriding thoughts of that is, which we know it won't happen, the police need to act like the police in accordance with British law and should treat them the same as anybody. If they are breaking the law or breaking the rules, then they should treat them exactly the same. If they're not, then, okay, obviously that needs to be looked at, whether no matter where they're from or who they are. That's a police issue.
That's what I think. But I do think that the police force, I've spoken to a lot of police officers, quite senior now as well, that are saying it's just changed so much since the 90s that you can't do shit without getting, you know, you don't open your mouth and say
Unfortunately, you got to take the police side on some of that as well. If they are holding back or not enforcing the law as much as they would maybe against a white right wing group, you got to look at it, because we're all humans again. Is that police officer thinking, well, there's mobile phones everywhere, is something I do now, which is completely justified for that police officer, who's going to be taken out of context with a TikTok short or whatever it is of them doing something to a different group, and is their life then going to be made miserable? Right. So that's going to be in the back of their mind.
Yeah, this multiculturalism, you know, it just doesn't work. It's like I said years ago in Middlesbrough, they've got so many different cultures in Middlesbrough that you know, the Sikhs hate the Indians hate them, and I'm thinking that's a tinderbox waiting to kick off. And if the police go in, what are they going to do? Do you know what I mean? They all hate each other for some reason. Some all different cultures on what we call England is getting changed massively. The heritage, everything's getting destroyed. And you just got to look.
Well, Chris is one of them. If you listen to his podcast, he hates the Welsh.
I'm
a racist.
My nan always used to say, if you find a good Welshman, shoot him before he turns bad. I've stuck with that my whole life, and it served me very well. We're going to get taken off the air again.
Yeah. You got to look inward, mate. It's like, why would the Welsh turn bad against you? What have we done? That's what you got to ask yourself. What have we done to the Welsh that's made them turn bad?
We ate all your sheep.
Yeah, your street got two houses. Yeah, yours is the one in the middle. Oh, Wales. Where the men are men.
That's what we need to be taken off air from. Crap jokes like that, mate.
Yes. I remember the first time I went to Wales as a kid, my mate's dad took us for some reason, some business trip or something. And, it was brilliant. I was so excited. First other country I'd ever visited. I have nothing bad to say about the place. I was up there the other day in Welshpool. That is the Welsh side of the border, Lee, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
It's like Hereford Way, isn't it?
Yeah, they're probably one of those, like Monmouth, which is in Wales, but they hate Welsh people. They think they're above... It's one of those weird border places like Monmouth, they're Welsh. If they speak to somebody from England, they probably pretend to be English. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's a bit like Birkenhead with Liverpool. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, can't remember what it was. Yeah, I was in a sweat lodge, sweating... naked with a bunch of strangers. I tell you what, you're gonna just don't knock it till you try it.
We went skiing in Bavaria when I was in the Marines, and there was the rumors there's a naked sauna in town. We're like, well, we're bootnecks, we gotta go and check it out. So we went down, and it weren't just a naked sauna, it was like a leisure complex, a resort. and everyone was naked. There was saunas, outdoor hot spa pools, a bar. You just, like, people sat at the bar having a beer, just naked, everyone. And it was everyone from the older generation to teenagers. And I was sat in one sauna, and there was two, like, 14-year-old girls in there, naked, right? And I just felt awkward. I couldn't look, but to them, it's completely normal.
Yeah.
Just that out of place. But everyone was just naked. Yeah, it was, like you said, liberating, mate. It was a very liberating experience. But you probably, how long did it take you to get to Welsh pool? Because it's all 20 miles an hour everywhere down here.
Oh, mate, I'll tell you what. From Guz, it was like 5 hours 20. Yeah. I mean, that's ridiculous. Should be able to get to
across the roads. Yeah, when you go up through mid Wales, the roads are.
I bloody hate it. I was wagon driving, and every time you used to do a Wales run, it's like, oh God, up and down, round and round. Fucking hell, you know what I mean? It was like, well, how long to delivery? How long before you get there? It says 50 miles, but it'd be about freaking 2 hours at this rate. Oh, up and down the bloody valleys. Little villages, tight roads, bloody nightmare in a wagon. Nice, though. Yeah.
Yeah. I would take that over to Birmingham or London any day of the week.
Yeah, yeah. I was working
Not when you drive for a living, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, but what we're going to talk about there, bushcraft next year.
Chris. Yes, the bushcraft. I've put it out to all my paying supporters at the moment, all the people that support the channel. Get free tickets to all my events anyway. All for the bushcraft, all you have to do is pay the camping, because the site asks for £30 for the camping. We're going to do an extra night this year, Kenny.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those people that have been quite good to the channel over the years, such as yourself, Susie, Chrissy, too many names to mention, we can all have a night. We can go up there on the Thursday, get the fire going, get the teepee up, and have a bit of a banyan.
Yeah.
And then actually start the bushcraft weekend the next day. So, yes. So, if you're watching
I love keeping the fire going. And you're young in as well in the morning when the fire was out. Get it going then. And then, the youngsters getting in there and chopping wood and that.
Go on,
get it going.
It's the way life. Yeah, it's the way life should be. Right.
And we stood there. This is what it was about. It was like, we all turn up, we're in this woods, and we're going to do fire vibration. But we're all going to get our tents out, and then we're all going to get this bloody big fire, and we're going to sit there and we'll have a bit of crack. And even when it poured down, it was like, we got the big tarp above us, we were all sat there, a bit damp and that, but nobody was whinging.
No,
we were just by the fire. We're all by it, having a bit of crack. And that was what it was all about. Under the stars, couldn't give a monkey, so it was nice. Nice.
Yeah, it was. I'll just get the flyer up if I can find it. Where is it?
And then you learn some skills.
There we go. Yeah. So Susie's asking, where is it? It's the same place as last time. It's Staffordshire, isn't it? That's not that far from you.
Canuck.
That's not that far from you, Lee, is it? Canuck Chase. is it like across?
Down the road, mate. Yeah, just down the road.
Is it really nowhere near?
I'm South Wales.
It's got to be closer than Plymouth, though, isn't it?
Yeah, because you got to go around, haven't you?
All right, I'm just saying it, so it'd be be great to have you come.
It's close to Wales, but no, I'm South Wales. It'd be closer than Plymouth.
Yeah, it'd be great to have you come along. It's September the 6th, everyone, till the 8th. Yes, there you go. I'll put the tickets out to everyone shortly, but at the moment I've just put it out to people that support the channel.
Can I bring the camper van? I'm a duvet marine now. Do you mean those days of roughing it behind me, mate?
Hey, mate.
I was thinking that.
Absolutely.
I'm a baby caravan.
Seriously, Kenny, there's place to park there, isn't there? There's plenty of places to park.
Yeah. It's massive. It's massive, isn't it? Huge. They have jamborees and all sorts there. It's huge.
Yes.
Well, I was looking at sharking it thinking, yeah, next time I'll bring the caravan. Drive down the caravan, park it up there, out of the way.
Get the dog.
Well, we had a massive
Teepee
with a big, huge stove inside it, and it was just incredible. It's my friend Steve's. It was good stuff. Sorry, people keep buzzing me. Right, gentlemen, I'd love to chat for ages, but I think we should bring it to an end there. Otherwise, people are going to watch it and go, it's not New Year's Eve anymore. I'm not going to watch that.
All we can say is be vigilant, be positive. There's a lot of shit going to go down, but see it for what it is. Know thy enemy.
Yes. Have you guys got time just to do 10 minutes on our locals channel?
Yeah.
Is that cool?
Yeah.
Right. Friends at home, there's a lot of stuff I want to ask Lee about his channel crossing, and I'm sure Kenny does that. It, as we've already found out once today, you can't ask on certain platforms because otherwise they get rid of you. So we're going to go and do that on locals now. So the link for our locals friends is in the description below. We're going to see you there in 3 minutes. That just leaves me to say, Lee, massive thank you, Royal. Coming on at the last minute. Wish you all the best with your bar. It's a cider bar, isn't it? It's
no, craft beer bar.
Sorry, craft beer. And the best luck with your writing and your adventures. And Kenny, massive thank you for everything you've done for the channel this last year. All the times you've helped me co-host the Bushcraft Weekend. And just being a damn fine friend, mate. Massive thank you. And that leads me to thank all our subscribers and our paying supporters. I know I mention that a lot, folks, but I'm a one-man band. I believe we've got quite a powerful message to put out on this channel. I can't do it on my own. So it's great that you're supporting me. And in the new year, we're going to try and expand the operation a bit more. So thank you to everyone that supported us on Locals, Patreon or YouTube members. If you become a YouTube member, folks, you get all my life coaching videos and all our back catalogue that we don't have on YouTube. You can go through that. Like I say, free tickets to all my events, etc. Locals is where we do uncensored material, and Patreon is all the same bonuses, folks, except the uncensored material. Right, I got there in the end. Fellas, massive thank you again. Big love to everybody out there. We'll see you on Locals in about 3 minutes. Ciao, ciao. Have an absolutely brilliant 2024.
Friends, thank you for listening to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Please like, subscribe and share. And don't forget to follow me on social media. Username, Chris Thrall. Instagram, Chris.Thrall. Thank you.